This is Audible.
Audible Incorporated presents Wuthering Heights, written by Emily Bronte, narrated by Joanne Froggatt. Hello, this is Joanne Froggatt, coming to you from Audible Studios in London. I'm so thrilled to have performed Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights for you, as it has been one of my favourite books since I was a child. I hope you enjoy it. Before we move into the story, we've got an exclusive introduction for you written by the Chief Curator of the Bronte Museum, Anne Dinsdale. If you'd prefer to go straight to the book itself, just skip to the next track.
An introduction by Anne Dinsdale and read by Rachel Atkins. Read Jane Eyre, but burn Wuthering Heights, advised a critic writing for Peterson's magazine in 1848, the year after both novels were originally published. Although Wuthering Heights is now considered to be one of the great classics of English literature, this didn't seem likely to be the case when it first appeared in December 1847 under the androgynous-sounding pseudonym Ellis Bell. Jane Eyre by Currer Bell, which had been published 3 months before Wuthering Heights, had enjoyed a phenomenal success, so the appearance of another Bell novel was bound to attract notice. Although critics picked up on a distinct family likeness between the two books, the majority were repelled by Wuthering Heights. One particularly negative review of the novel reads, "There is an old saying that those who eat toasted cheese at night will dream of Lucifer. The author of Wuthering Heights has evidently eaten toasted cheese. How a human being could have attempted such a book at the present without committing suicide is a mystery. It is a compound of vulgar depravity and unnatural horrors." Despite their general condemnation, the book's first reviewers were forced to acknowledge the power and originality of Ellis Bell's writing, qualities which were associated with male authorship. Whilst there was a great deal of speculation over the gender of Currer Bell, there was no doubt in the minds of readers and reviewers that Wuthering Heights had been written by a man. In fact, it was felt that Ellis Bell had taken these qualities too far, and that the degree of profanity and savageness in the book revealed Ellis Bell to be a man not accustomed to the society of gentlemen, and one who rather gloried in showing it. Attitudes to Wuthering Heights began to change after a preface and biographical notice by Currer Bell appeared in the second edition of the novel, published in 1850. It was revealed for the first time that Ellis Bell, author of Wuthering Heights and man of uncommon talents but dogged, brutal and morose, was a clergyman's daughter, who had lived an outwardly uneventful life in a remote Yorkshire parsonage. Emily Jane Bronte had died of tuberculosis at the age of 30, a year after the publication of her only novel, and never lived to see how her work would be lauded in years to come. She was born on the 30th of July 1818, the fifth of six children of Patrick and Maria Bronte. The two eldest daughters died in childhood. The third was Charlotte, author of Jane Eyre, and the fourth was Patrick Branwell, the only boy whose early promise was blighted by alcoholism. The youngest was Anne, Acton Bell, who went on to publish two novels, Agnes Grey and The Tenant of Wildfell Hall. In 1820, Mr. Bronte was appointed perpetual curate of Haworth, and from that point onwards, the Bronte family's home became a rather bleak parsonage on the edge of the Yorkshire moors. The parsonage and its surroundings became central to Emily's creative life and had a profound influence on her writing. Mrs. Bronte died in the following year, and her sister, Elizabeth Branwell, left a comfortable home in Penzance to take charge of the Bronte household. In 1825, Mr. Bronte brought in a local woman, Tabby Ackroyd, to assist with the domestic work at the parsonage. The parsonage kitchen became Tabby's domain, and during the day she would chide the children for pitter-pottering when there was work to be done. In the evening they would gather in the firelit kitchen to hear Tabby's tales of dark deeds, fairies, and hauntings. Through her network of family and friends in the village, Tabby knew the histories of most of the local families and would recount her stories to the children without any sense that some of her material might not be suitable for young ears. It was possibly through Tabby that Emily learnt of past tragedies concerning the Heaton family, one of which involved an attempted usurpation of the family fortunes by a Heathcliff-like figure named Henry Casson. For generations, the Heatons had lived at Pondon Hall, a 17th-century house lying in a valley about 2 miles from Haworth, which is often suggested as the original for Thrushcross Grange, the home of the Lintons in Wuthering Heights, although in appearance it much more closely resembles the Heights. A date plaque above the door of the hall states that the house was rebuilt by Robert Heaton in 1801, the year, incidentally, that Wuthering Heights opens. Pondon also comes complete with its own ghost, one which puts in an appearance when a member of the Heaton family is about to die. It was also from Tabby that the children learnt the Yorkshire dialect, and she is likely to have provided a model for Ellen Dean in Wuthering Heights. Tabby's tales were supplemented by those related by Mr. Bronte over the breakfast table. He would tell his children thrilling stories of his youth in Ireland and of the Luddite violence he had experienced first-hand during his time as curate at Hartshead, when desperate men would gather at night to attack local mills and destroy the newly installed machinery which threatened their livelihoods. After breakfast, the children studied the Bible with their father, as well as geography and history. Mr. Bronte instilled a love of learning in all his children, and they read anything they could lay their hands on, taking particular delight in Blackwood's Magazine, the novels of Sir Walter Scott, and the poetry of Lord Byron. The Brontes had little contact with children of their own age, and outside lesson time developed their own rich imaginary world, sparked by their father's gift to Branwell of a set of toy soldiers. Each of the children adopted a soldier, creating a sequence of plays around them, which grew in complexity over the years. Everything the children read or heard fed into these imaginary worlds, and from acting out the stories, the children were soon chronicling the histories of the imaginary kingdoms in miniature books. Eventually, Emily and Anne broke away from the dominance of their elder siblings to create their own land of Gondol. The prose manuscripts relating to the Gondol saga have not survived, and the few clues to Gondol are to be found in the poetry produced by both sisters, and in brief references contained in the sisters' diary papers. In a diary paper written on the 24th of November, 1834, Emily produced a snapshot of parsonage life which makes clear how happily the domestic life of Haworth Parsonage coexisted alongside the epic goings-on of the imaginary world. The Gondols are discovering the interior of Geldine. Sally Mosley is washing in the back kitchen. Apart from brief excursions to school, including time spent studying in Brussels, and one attempt at earning her living as a teacher, Emily remained at home for the greater part of her life. As the stay-at-home sister, she took on many of the household chores. Baking the bread and working in the kitchen allowed her the mental freedom to focus on her writing. She was less open to outside influences than her sisters, and unlike them, never saw any necessity to abandon the imaginary world developed in childhood, so that the themes of her adult writing carry on seamlessly from those of her youth. When Charlotte, Emily and Anne joined forces to publish a collection of their poems in 1845, Emily contributed a selection of poems originally spoken by Gondalian characters, which she carefully edited to remove all references to Gondal. When the slim volume of poetry sold only 2 copies, each of the sisters set to work on writing a novel. The dramatic and the domestic had always gone hand in hand for Emily, performing tasks in the kitchen while absorbing Tabby's dark tales of long-dead families. It seems that in writing her novel, Emily relocated a Gondal drama, which she played out against the homely background of a Yorkshire farmhouse. Wuthering Heights is an enigmatic book. One early reviewer described it as a strange sort of book, baffling all regular criticism, a verdict that few critics would disagree with. The lack of any moral in the story was perhaps what really disturbed critics the most. For other than confirmation of the brutalizing influence of unchecked passions, no moral message could be discerned. The violence in the novel, considered shocking in 1847, can still surprise us today. An early critic predicted that Wuthering Heights would live a short and brilliant life and then die and be forgotten. Poor Cathy's ghost will not wander the earth forever, and the insane Heathcliff will soon rest quietly in his coveted repose. This has not proved to be the case. In the intervening years, the novel has been translated into more than 30 languages, and its characters and themes have become part of popular culture. Wuthering Heights has been adapted many times for film, television and stage, as well as inspiring ballets, operas and musicals. There have been prequels, sequels, graphic novels, and now, in the bicentenary of Emily Bronte's birth, a new audio edition of Wuthering Heights, narrated by one of the nation's most popular actors. Now, without any further ado, settle in for Joanne Froggatt's captivating performance of Wuthering Heights. Anne Dinsdale.
Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte. Chapter 1. 1801. I have just returned from a visit to my landlord, the solitary neighbour that I shall be troubled with. This is certainly a beautiful country. In all England I do not believe that I could have fixed on a situation so completely removed from the stir of society. A perfect misanthropist's heaven. And Mr. Heathcliff and I are such a suitable pair to divide the desolation between us. A capital fellow. He little imagined how my heart warmed towards him when I beheld his black eyes withdraw so suspiciously under their brows as I rode up, and when his fingers sheltered themselves with a jealous resolution still further into his waistcoat as I announced my name. "Mr. Heathcliff," I said. A nod was the answer. "Mr. Lockwood, your new tenant, sir. I do myself the honour of calling as soon as possible after my arrival, to express the hope that I have not inconvenienced you by my perseverance in soliciting the occupation of Thrushcross Grange. I heard yesterday you had had some thoughts." "Thrushcross Grange is my own, sir," he interrupted, wincing. "I should not allow anyone to inconvenience me, if I could hinder it. Walk in." The "walk in" was uttered with closed teeth, and expressed the sentiment, "Go to the deuce." Even the gait over which he leant manifested no sympathizing movement to the words. And I think that circumstance determined me to accept the invitation. I felt interested in a man who seemed more exaggeratedly reserved than myself. When he saw my horse's breast fairly pushing the barrier, he did put out his hand to unchain it, and then sullenly preceded me up the causeway, calling as we entered the court, "Joseph, take Mr. Lockwood's horse, and bring up some wine." "Here we have the whole establishment of domestics, I suppose," was the reflection suggested by this compound order. "No wonder the grass grows up between the flags, and cattle are the only hedge-cutters." Joseph was an elderly, nay, an old man, very old perhaps, though hale and sinewy.
"The Lord help us,"
he soliloquized in an undertone of peevish displeasure, while relieving me of my horse, looking meantime in my face so sourly that I charitably conjectured he must have need of divine aid to digest his dinner, and his pious ejaculation had no reference to my unexpected advent. Wuthering Heights is the name of Mr. Heathcliff's dwelling, Wuthering being a significant provincial adjective, descriptive of the atmospheric tumult to which its station is exposed in stormy weather. Pure bracing ventilation they must have up there at all times, indeed. One may guess the power of the north wind blowing over the edge by the excessive slant of a few stunted firs at the end of the house, and by a range of gaunt thorns all stretching their limbs one way, as if craving arms of the sun. Happily, the architect had foresight to build it strong. The narrow windows are deeply set in the wall, and the corners defended with large jutting stones. Before passing the threshold, I paused to admire a quantity of grotesque carving, lavished over the front, and especially about the principal door, above which, among a wildness of crumbling griffins and shameless little boys, I detected the date 1500, and the name Hareton Earnshaw. I would have made a few comments, and requested a short history of the place from the surly owner, but his attitude at the door appeared to demand my speedy entrance or complete departure, and I had no desire to aggravate his impatience previous to inspecting the penetralium. One stop brought us into the family sitting room, without any introductory lobby or passage. They call it here the house, preeminently. It includes kitchen and parlour, generally, but I believe at Wuthering Heights the kitchen is forced to retreat altogether into another quarter. At least I distinguished a chatter of tongues and a clatter of culinary utensils deep within. And I observed no signs of roasting, boiling, or baking about the huge fireplace, nor any glitter of copper saucepans and tin colanders on the walls. One end, indeed, reflected splendidly both light and heat from ranks of immense pewter dishes, interspersed with silver jugs and tankards, towering row after row on a vast oak dresser to the very roof. The latter had never been underdrawn. Its entire anatomy lay bare to an inquiring eye, except where a frame of wood laden with oatcakes and clusters of legs of beef, mutton and ham concealed it. Above the chimney were sundry villainous old guns, and a couple of horse pistols, and by way of ornament, three gaudily painted canisters disposed along its ledge. The floor was of smooth white stone, the chairs high-backed, primitive structures painted green, one or two heavy black ones lurking in the shade. In an arch under the dresser reposed a huge liver-coloured bitch pointer, surrounded by a swarm of squealing puppies, and other dogs haunted other recesses. The apartment and furniture would have been nothing extraordinary as belonging to a homely northern farmer, with a stubborn countenance and stalwart limbs set out to advantage in knee breeches and gaiters. Such an individual seated in his armchair, his mug of ale frothing on the round table before him, is to be seen in any circuit of 5 or 6 miles among these hills if you go at the right time after dinner. But Mr. Heathcliff forms a singular contrast to his abode and style of living. He is a dark-skinned gypsy in aspect, in dress and manners a gentleman. That is as much a gentleman as many a country squire, rather slovenly perhaps, yet not looking amiss with his negligence, because he has an erect and handsome figure, and rather morose. Possibly some people might suspect him of a degree of underbred pride. I have a sympathetic chord within that tells me it is nothing of the sort. I know by instinct his reserve springs from an aversion to showy displays of feeling, to manifestations of mutual kindliness. He'll love and hate equally under cover, and esteem it a species of impertinence to be loved or hated again. No, I'm running on too fast. I bestow my own attributes over-liberally on him. Mr. Heathcliff may have entirely dissimilar reasons for keeping his hand out of the way when he meets a would-be acquaintance to those which actuate me. Let me hope my constitution is almost peculiar. My dear mother used to say I should never have a comfortable home, and only last summer I proved myself perfectly unworthy of one. While enjoying a month of fine weather at the seacoast, I was thrown into the company of a most fascinating creature, a real goddess in my eyes, as long as she took no notice of me. I never told my love vocally. Still, if looks have language, the merest idiot might have guessed I was over head and ears. She understood me at last, and looked a return. the sweetest of all imaginable looks. And what did I do? I confess it with shame, shrunk icily into myself, like a snail, at every glance, retired colder and farther, till finally the poor innocent was led to doubt her own senses, and overwhelmed with confusion at her supposed mistake, persuaded her mamma to decamp. By this curious turn of disposition, I have gained the reputation of deliberate heartlessness. How undeserved, I alone can appreciate. I took a seat at the end of the hearthstone, opposite that towards which my landlord advanced, and filled up an interval of silence by attempting to caress the canine mother, who had left her nursery, and was sneaking wolfishly to the back of my legs, her lip curled up, and her white teeth watering for a snatch. My caress provoked a long guttural gnarl. "You'd better let the dog alone," growled Mr. Heathcliff in unison, checking fiercer demonstrations with a punch of his foot. "She's not accustomed to be spoiled. Not kept for a pet." Then, striding to a side door, he shouted again,
"Joseph!"
Joseph mumbled indistinctly in the depths of the cellar, but gave no intimation of ascending, so his master dived down to him, leaving me, vis-a-vis, the ruffianly bitch and a pair of grim, shaggy sheepdogs, who shared with her a jealous guardianship over all my movements. Not anxious to come in contact with their fangs, I sat still, but imagining they would scarcely understand tacit insults, I unfortunately indulged in winking and making faces at the trio, and some turn of my physiognomy so irritated Madam that she suddenly broke into a fury and leapt on my knees. I flung her back, and hastened to interpose the table between us. This proceeding aroused the whole hive. Half a dozen four-footed fiends of various sizes and ages issued from hidden dens to the common centre. I felt my heels and coat-laps peculiar subjects of assault, and parrying off the larger combatants as effectually as I could with the poker, I was constrained to demand aloud assistance from some of the household in re-establishing peace. Mr. Heathcliff and his man climbed the cellar steps with vexatious phlegm. I don't think they moved one second faster than usual, though the hearth was an absolute tempest of worrying and yelping. Happily, an inhabitant of the kitchen made more dispatch, a lusty dame with tucked-up gown, bare arms and fire-flushed cheeks, rushed into the midst of us flourishing a frying pan, and used that weapon and her tongue to such purpose that the storm subsided magically, and she only remained, heaving like a sea after a high wind, when her master entered on the scene. "What the devil is the matter?" he asked, eyeing me in a manner that I could ill endure after this inhospitable treatment. "What the devil indeed?" I muttered. "The herd of possessed swine could have had no worse spirits in them than those animals of yours, sir. You might as well leave a stranger with a brood of tigers." "They won't meddle with persons who touch nothing," he remarked, putting the bottle before me and restoring the displaced table. "The dogs do right to be vigilant. Take a glass of wine." "No, thank you. Not bitten, are you?" "If I had been, I would have set my signet on the biter." Heathcliff's countenance relaxed into a grin. "Come, come," he said. "You are flurried, Mr. Lockwood. Here, take a little wine. Guests are so exceedingly rare in this house that I and my dogs, I am willing to own, hardly know how to receive them. Your health, sir." I bowed and returned the pledge, beginning to perceive that it would be foolish to sit sulking for the misbehaviour of a pack of curs. Besides, I felt loath to yield the fellow further amusement at my expense, since his humour took that turn. He, probably swayed by prudential consideration of the folly of offending a good tenant, relaxed a little in the laconic style of chipping off his pronouns and auxiliary verbs, and introduced what he supposed would be a subject of interest to me. a discourse on the advantages and disadvantages of my present place of retirement. I found him very intelligent on the topics we touched, and before I went home, I was encouraged so far as to volunteer another visit tomorrow. He evidently wished no repetition of my intrusion. I shall go, notwithstanding. It is astonishing how sociable I feel myself compared with him. Chapter 2. Yesterday afternoon set in misty and cold. I had half a mind to spend it by my study fire instead of wading through heath and mud to Wuthering Heights. On coming up from dinner, however, N.B., I dine between 12 and 1 o'clock, the housekeeper, a matronly lady taken as a fixture along with the house, could not or would not comprehend my request that I might be served at 5. On mounting the stairs with this lazy intention, and stepping into the room, I saw a servant girl on her knees surrounded by brushes and coal scuttles, and raising an infernal dust as she extinguished the flames with heaps of cinders. This spectacle drove me back immediately. I took my hat, and after a 4 miles walk, arrived at Heathcliff's garden gate just in time to escape the first feathery flakes of a snow shower. On that bleak hilltop the earth was hard with a black frost, and the air made me shiver through every limb. Being unable to remove the chain, I jumped over, and, running up the flagged causeway bordered with straggling gooseberry bushes, knocked vainly for admittance till my knuckles tingled and the dogs howled. "Wretched inmates," I ejaculated mentally. "You deserve perpetual isolation from your species for your churlish inhospitality. At least I would not keep my doors barred in the daytime. I don't care, I will get in." So resolved, I grasped the latch and shook it vehemently. Vinegar-faced Joseph projected his head from a round window of the barn.
"What are you here for?"
he shouted.
"That master's down in fold. Go round but end at Lath if you want to speak to him."
"Is there nobody inside to open the door?" I hallowed responsively.
"There's not but missus, and she'll not open. You can make your flane some dins till neat."
"Why? Cannot you tell her whom I am, eh, Joseph?"
"None of me. I'll hear no end wi' it,"
muttered the head, vanishing. The snow began to drive thickly. I seized the handle to essay another trial, when a young man without coat and shouldering a pitchfork appeared in the yard behind. He hailed me to follow him, and, after marching through a wash-house and a paved area containing a coal shed, pump and pigeon cot, we at length arrived in the huge, warm, cheerful apartment where I was formerly received. It glowed delightfully in the radiance of an immense fire, compounded of coal, peat and wood. And near the table laid for a plentiful evening meal, I was pleased to observe the missus, an individual whose existence I had never previously suspected. I bowed and waited, thinking she would bid me take a seat. She looked at me, leaning back in her chair, and remained motionless and mute. "Rough weather," I remarked. "I'm afraid, Mrs. Heathcliff, the door must bear the consequence of your servant's leisure attendance. I had hard work to make them hear me." She never opened her mouth. I stared. She stared also. At any rate, she kept her eyes on me in a cool, regardless manner, exceedingly embarrassing and disagreeable.
"Sit down,"
said the young man gruffly. "You'll be in soon." I obeyed, and hemmed and called the villain Juno, who deigned, at this second interview, to move the extreme tip of her tail in token of owning my acquaintance. "A beautiful animal," I commenced again. "Do you intend parting with the little ones, madam?" "They are not mine," said the amiable hostess, more repellingly than Heathcliff himself could have replied. "Ah, your favourites are among these," I continued, turning to an obscure cushion full of something like cats. "A strange choice of favourites," she observed scornfully. Unluckily, it was a heap of dead rabbits. I hemmed once more and drew closer to the hearth, repeating my comment on the wildness of the evening. "You should not have come out," she said, rising and reaching from the chimney piece two of the painted canisters. Her position before was sheltered from the light. Now I had a distinct view of her whole figure and countenance. She was slender and apparently scarcely past girlhood, an admirable form, and the most exquisite little face that I have ever had the pleasure of beholding. Small features, very fair, flaxen ringlets, or rather golden, hanging loose on her delicate neck. And eyes, had they been agreeable in expression, that would have been irresistible. Fortunately for my susceptible heart, the only sentiment they evinced hovered between scorn and a kind of desperation, singularly unnatural to be detected there. The canisters were almost out of her reach. I made a motion to aid her. She turned up on me as a miser might turn if anyone attempted to assist him in counting his gold. "I don't want your help," she snapped. "I can get them for myself." "I beg your pardon," I hastened to reply. "Were you asked to tea?" she demanded, tying an apron over her neat black frock and standing with a spoonful of the leaf poised over the pot. "I shall be glad to have a cup," I answered. "Were you asked?" she repeated. "No," I said, half smiling. "You are the proper person to ask me." She flung the tea back, spoon and all, and resumed her chair in a pet, her forehead corrugated and her red underlip pushed out, like a child's ready to cry. Meanwhile, the young man had slung onto his person a decidedly shabby upper garment, and erecting himself before the blaze, looked down on me from the corner of his eyes, for all the world as if there were some mortal feud unavenged between us. I began to doubt whether he were a servant or not. His dress and speech were both rude, entirely devoid of the superiority observable in Mr. and Mrs. Heathcliff. His thick brown curls were rough and uncultivated. His whiskers encroached bearishly over his cheeks, and his hands were embrowned like those of a common labourer. Still, his bearing was free, almost haughty, and he showed none of a domestic's assiduity in attending on the lady of the house. In the absence of clear proofs of his condition, I deemed it best to abstain from noticing his curious conduct. And, 5 minutes afterwards, the entrance of Heathcliff relieved me, in some measure, from my uncomfortable state. "You see, sir, I am come according to promise," I exclaimed, assuming the cheerful. "And I fear I shall be weather-bound for half an hour if you can afford me shelter during that space." "Half an hour," he said, shaking the white flakes from his clothes. "I wonder you should select the thick of a snowstorm to ramble about in. Do you know that you run a risk of being lost in the marshes? People familiar with these moors often miss their road on such evenings, and I can tell you there is no chance of change at present. Perhaps I can get a guide among your lads, and he might stay at the Grange till morning. Could you spare me one?"
"No, I could not."
"Oh, indeed. Well, then I must trust to my own sagacity."
"Are you going to make the tea?"
demanded he of the shabby coat, shifting his ferocious gaze from me to the young lady.
"Is he to have any?"
she asked, appealing to Heathcliff.
"Get it ready, will you?"
was the answer, uttered so savagely that I started. The tone in which the words were said revealed a genuine bad nature. I no longer felt inclined to call Heathcliff a capital fellow. When the preparations were finished, he invited me with,
"Now, sir, bring forward your chair."
And we all, including the rustic youth, drew round the table, an austere silence prevailing while we discussed our meal. I thought if I had caused the cloud, it was my duty to make an effort to dispel it. They could not every day sit so grim and taciturn, and it was impossible, however ill-tempered they might be, that the universal scowl they wore was their everyday countenance. It is strange, I began in the interval of swallowing one cup of tea and receiving another. It is strange how custom can mould our tastes and ideas. Many could not imagine the existence of happiness in a life of such complete exile from the world as you spend, Mr. Heathcliff. Yet I'll venture to say that surrounded by your family and with your amiable lady as the presiding genius over your home and heart... My amiable lady, he interrupted, with an almost diabolical sneer on his face. Where is she, my amiable lady? Mrs. Heathcliff, your wife, I mean. Well, yes. Oh, you would intimate that her spirit has taken the post of ministering angel and guards the fortune of Wuthering Heights. Even when her body is gone, is that it? Perceiving myself in a blunder, I attempted to correct it. I might have seen there was too great a disparity between the ages of the parties to make it likely that they were man and wife. One was about 40, a period of mental vigour at which men seldom cherish the delusion of being married for love by girls. That dream is reserved for the solace of our declining years. The other did not look 17. Then it flashed on me. The clown at my elbow, who is drinking his tea out of a basin and eating his broad with unwashed hands, may be her husband. Heathcliff Junior, of course. Here is the consequence of being buried alive. She has thrown herself away upon that bore from sheer ignorance that better individuals existed. A sad pity. I must beware how I cause her to regret her choice. The last reflection may seem conceited. It was not. My neighbour struck me as bordering on repulsive. I knew through experience that I was tolerably attractive. Mrs. Heathcliff is my daughter-in-law, said Heathcliff, corroborating my surmise. He turned as he spoke, a peculiar look in her direction, a look of hatred, unless he has a most perverse set of facial muscles that will not, like those of other people, interpret the language of his soul. Ah, certainly, I see now. You are the favoured possessor of the beneficent fairy, I remarked, turning to my neighbour. This was worse than before. The youth grew crimson and clenched his fist, with every appearance of a meditated assault. But he seemed to recollect himself presently, and smothered the storm in a brutal curse muttered on my behalf, which, however, I took care not to notice. Unhappy in your conjectures, sir, observed my host. We neither of us have the privilege of owning your good fairy. Her mate is dead. I said she was my daughter-in-law, therefore she must have married my son. And this young man is? Not my son, assuredly. Heathcliff smiled again, as if it were rather too bold a jest to attribute the paternity of that bear to him. My name is Hareton Earnshaw, growled the other, and I'd counsel you to respect it. I've shown no disrespect, was my reply, laughing internally at the dignity with which he announced himself. He fixed his eye on me longer than I cared to return the stare, for fear I might be tempted either to box his ears or render my hilarity audible. I began to feel unmistakably out of place in that pleasant family circle. The dismal spiritual atmosphere overcame, and more than neutralized, the glowing physical comforts around me, and I resolved to be cautious how I ventured under those rafters a third time. The business of eating being concluded, and no one uttering a word of sociable conversation, I approached a window to examine the weather. A sorrowful sight I saw, dark night coming down prematurely, and sky and hills mingled in one bitter whirl of wind and suffocating snow. I don't think it possible for me to get home now without a guide, I could not help exclaiming. The roads will be buried already, and if they were bare, I could scarcely distinguish a foot in advance. Hareton, drive those dozen sheep into the barn porch. They'll be covered if left in the fold all night, and put a plank before them, said Heathcliff. How must I do? I continued with rising irritation. There was no reply to my question, and on looking round, I saw only Joseph bringing in a pail of porridge for the dogs. and Mrs. Heathcliff leaning over the fire, diverting herself with burning a bundle of matches, which had fallen from the chimney-piece as she restored the tea canister to its place. The former, when he had deposited his burden, took a critical survey of the room, and in cracked tones grated out.
"Ah, I wonder how you can fashion to stand there in idleness and war, when all of 'em's gone out. And you're a nowt, and it's no use talking. You'll ne'er mend your ill ways. They'll go right to devil like your mother afore you."
I imagined for a moment this piece of eloquence was addressed to me, and sufficiently enraged, stepped towards the aged rascal with an intention of kicking him out of the door. Mrs. Heathcliff, however, checked me by her answer.
"You scandalous old hypocrite," she replied.
"Are you not afraid of being carried away bodily whenever you mention the devil's name? I warn you to refrain from provoking me, or I'll ask your abduction as a special favour. Stop! Look here, Joseph!"
she continued, taking a long dark book from a shelf.
"I'll show you how far I've progressed in the black art. I shall soon be competent to make a clear house of it. The red cow didn't die by chance, and your rheumatism can hardly be reckoned among providential visitations."
"Oh, wicked! Wicked!"
gasped the elder.
"May the Lord deliver us from evil."
"No, reprobate! You are a castaway. Be off, or I'll hurt you seriously. I'll have you all modelled in wax and clay, and the first who passes the limits I fix shall..."
I'll not say what he shall be done to, but you'll see.
"Go, I'm looking at you."
The little witch put a mock malignity into her beautiful eyes, and Joseph, trembling with sincere horror, hurried out, praying and ejaculating, "Wicked!" as he went. I thought her conduct must be prompted by a species of dreary fun. And now that we were alone, I endeavoured to interest her in my distress. "Mrs. Heathcliff," I said earnestly, "you must excuse me for troubling you, I presume because, with that face, I'm sure you cannot help being good-hearted. Do point out some landmarks by which I may know my way home. I have no more idea how to get there than you would have how to get to London."
"Take the road you came,"
she answered, ensconcing herself in a chair with a candle and the long book open before her. "It is brief advice, but as sound as I can give." "Then if you hear of me being discovered dead in a bog or a pit full of snow, your conscience won't whisper that it is partly your fault."
"How so? I cannot escort you. They wouldn't let me go to the end of the garden wall."
"You? I should be sorry to ask you to cross the threshold for my convenience on such a night," I cried. "I want you to tell me my way, not to show it, or else to persuade Mr. Heathcliff to give me a guide."
"Who? There is himself, Earnshaw, Zillah, Joseph, and I. Which would you have?"
"Are there no boys at the farm?"
"No, those are all."
"Then it follows that I am compelled to stay."
"That you may settle with your host. I have nothing to do with it."
"I hope it will be a lesson to you to make no more rash journeys on these hills,"
cried Heathcliff's stern voice from the kitchen entrance.
"As to staying here, I don't keep accommodations for visitors. You must share a bed with Hareton or Joseph if you do."
"I can sleep in a chair in this room," I replied.
"No, no. A stranger is a stranger, be he rich or poor."
With this insult, my patience was at an end. I uttered an expression of disgust and pushed past him into the yard, running against Earnshaw in my haste. It was so dark that I could not see the means of exit, and as I wandered round, I heard another specimen of their civil behaviour amongst each other. At first, the young man appeared about to befriend me.
"I'll go with him as far as the park," he said.
"You'll go with him to hell,"
exclaimed his master, or whatever relation he bore.
"And who is to look after the horses, eh?"
"A man's life is of more consequence than one evening's neglect of the horses. Somebody must go," murmured Mrs. Heathcliff more kindly than I expected.
"Not at your command," retorted Hareton. "If you set store on him, you better be quiet."
"Then I hope his ghost will haunt you, and I hope Mr. Heathcliff will never get another tenant till the Grange is a ruin,"
she answered sharply.
Hearken, hearken, shoes cursing on him,
muttered Joseph, towards whom I had been steering. He sat within earshot milking the cows by the light of a lantern, which I seized unceremoniously, and calling out that I would send it back on the morrow, rushed to the nearest postern.
Master! Master, he's stealing lantern!
Shouted the ancient, pursuing my retreat.
Hey, Nasher! Hey, dog! Hey, wolf! Hold him! Hold him!
On opening the little door, two hairy monsters flew at my throat, bearing me down and extinguishing the light, while a mingled guffaw from Heathcliff and Hareton put the copestone on my rage and humiliation. Fortunately, the beasts seemed more bent on stretching their paws and yawning and flourishing their tails than devouring me alive. But they would suffer no resurrection, and I was forced to lie till their malignant masters pleased to deliver me. Then, hatless and trembling with wrath, I ordered the miscreants to let me out, on their peril to keep me 1 minute longer, with several incoherent threats of retaliation that, in their indefinite depth of virulency, smacked of King Lear. The vehemence of my agitation brought on a copious bleeding at the nose, and still Heathcliff laughed, and still I scolded. I don't know what would have concluded the scene had there not been one person at hand rather more rational than myself, and more benevolent than my entertainer. This was Zillah, the stout housewife, who at length issued forth to inquire into the nature of the uproar. She thought that some of them had been laying violent hands on me, and not daring to attack her master, she turned her vocal artillery against the younger scoundrel.
"Well, Mr. Earnshaw," she cried, "I wonder what you'll have agait next. Are we going to murder folk on our very doorstones? I see this house will never do for me. Look at poor lad, he's fair choking. Whist, whist, you mun't go on so. Come in and I'll cure that. There now, hold you still."
With these words, she suddenly splashed a pint of icy water down my neck and pulled me into the kitchen. Mr. Heathcliff followed, his accidental merriment expiring quickly in his habitual moroseness. I was sick exceedingly, and dizzy and faint, and thus compelled perforce to accept lodgings under his roof. He told Zillah to give me a glass of brandy, and then passed on into the inner room, while she condoled with me on my sorry predicament, and having obeyed his orders, whereby I was somewhat revived, ushered me to bed. Chapter 3. While leading the way upstairs, she recommended that I should hide the candle and not make a noise, for her master had an odd notion about the chamber she would put me in, and never let anybody lodge there willingly. I asked the reason. She did not know, she answered. She had only lived there a year or two, and they had so many queer goings on, she could not begin to be curious. Too stupefied to be curious myself, I fastened my door and glanced round for the bed. The whole furniture consisted of a chair, a clothes press, and a large oak case with squares cut out near the top resembling coach windows. Having approached this structure, I looked inside and perceived it to be a singular sort of old-fashioned couch, very conveniently designed to obviate the necessity for every member of the family having a room to himself. In fact, it formed a little closet, and the ledge of a window which it enclosed served as a table. I slid back the panelled sides, got in with my light, pulled them together again, and felt secure against the vigilance of Heathcliff and everyone else. The ledge where I placed my candle had a few mildewed books piled up in one corner, and it was covered with writing scratched on the paint. This writing, however, was nothing but a name repeated in all kinds of characters, large and small. Catherine Earnshaw, here and there varied to Catherine Heathcliff, and then again to Catherine Linton. In vapid listlessness, I leant my head against the window and continued spelling over Catherine Earnshaw, Heathcliff, Linton, till my eyes closed. They had not rested 5 minutes when a glare of white letters started from the dark, as vivid as spectres. The air swarmed with Catherines, and rousing myself to dispel the obtrusive name, I discovered my candle wick reclining on one of the antique volumes,
and perfuming the place with an odour of roasted calfskin. I snuffed it off, and very ill at ease under the influence of cold and lingering nausea, sat up and spread open the injured tome on my knee. It was a testament in lean type, and smelling dreadfully musty. A flyleaf bore the inscription, Catherine Earnshaw, her book, and a date some quarter of a century back. I shut it and took up another and another, till I had examined all. Catherine's library was select, and its state of dilapidation proved it to have been well used, though not altogether for a legitimate purpose. Scarcely one chapter had escaped a pen and ink commentary, at least the appearance of one, covering every morsel of blank that the printer had left. Some were detached sentences. Other parts took the form of a regular diary, scrawled in an unformed childish hand. At the top of an extra page, quite a treasure probably when first lighted on, I was greatly amused to behold an excellent caricature of my friend Joseph, rudely yet powerfully sketched. An immediate interest kindled within me for the unknown Catherine, and I began forthwith to decipher her faded hieroglyphics. An awful Sunday, commenced the paragraph beneath. I wish my father were back again. Hindley is a detestable substitute. His conduct to Heathcliff is atrocious. H and I are going to rebel. We took our initiatory step this evening. All day had been flooding with rain. We could not go to church, so Joseph must needs get up a congregation in the garret, and while Hindley and his wife basked downstairs before a comfortable fire, doing anything but reading their Bibles, I'll answer for it, Heathcliff, myself, and the unhappy ploughboy were commanded to take our prayer books and mount. We were ranged in a row on a sack of corn, groaning and shivering, and hoping that Joseph would shiver too, so that he might give us a short homily for his own sake. A vain idea. The service lasted precisely 3 hours, and yet my brother had the face to exclaim when he saw us descending, "What, done already?" On Sunday evenings we used to be permitted to play, if we did not make much noise. Now a mere titter is sufficient to send us into corners. "You forget you have a master here," says the tyrant. "I'll demolish the first who puts me out of temper. I insist on perfect sobriety and silence." "Oh, boy, was that you? Francis, darling, pull his hair as you go by. I heard him snap his fingers." Francis pulled his hair heartily, and then went and seated herself on her husband's knee, and there they were, like two babies kissing and talking nonsense by the hour. Foolish palaver that we should be ashamed of. We made ourselves as snug as our means allowed in the arch of the dresser. I had just fastened our pinafores together and hung them up for a curtain, when in comes Joseph on an errand from the stables. He tears down my handiwork, boxes my ears, and croaks. "T' master no but just buried, and Sabbath no end, and t' sound at gospel still in your lungs, and you dare be larking? Shame on you. Sit you down, ill childer. There's good books enough if you'll read 'em. Sit you down and think of your souls." Saying this, he compelled us to square our positions, that we might receive from the far-off fire a dull ray to show us the text of the lumber he thrust upon us. I could not bear the employment. I took my dingy volume by the scroop and hurled it into the dog kennel, vowing I hated a good book. Heathcliff kicked his to the same place. Then there was a hubbub.
"Master Hindley!"
shouted our chaplain.
"Master, come hither! Miss Cathy's riven that back at Helmet of Salvation, and Heathcliff's paused his fit into first part at Broadway to destruction. It's fair flacing that you let him go on this gate. Ick! Toe man would have laced him properly, but he's gone."
Hindley hurried up from his paradise on the hearth, and seizing one of us by the collar and the other by the arm, hurled both into the back kitchen, where Joseph asseverated.
"Old Nick would
fetch us, as sure as we were living, and so comforted we each sought a separate nook to await his advent. I reached this book and a pot of ink from a shelf, and pushed the house door ajar to give me light, and I have got the time on with writing for 20 minutes, but my companion is impatient and proposes that we should appropriate the dairywoman's cloak and have a scamper on the moors under its shelter. a pleasant suggestion. And then if the surly old man come in, he may believe his prophecy verified. We cannot be damper or colder in the rain than we are here.
I suppose Catherine fulfilled her project, for the next sentence took up another subject. She whacked lachrymose.
How little did I dream that Hindley would ever make me cry so!
She wrote,
My head aches, till I cannot keep it on the pillow, and still I can't give over. Poor Heathcliff! Hindley calls him a vagabond and won't let him sit with us, nor eat with us any more, and he says he and I must not play together, and threatens to turn him out of the house if we break his orders. He has been blaming our father, how dared he, for treating H too liberally, and swears he will reduce him to his right place.
I began to nod drowsily over the dim page. My eye wandered from manuscript to print. I saw a red ornamented title, 70 times 7 and the first of the 71st. A pious discourse delivered by the Reverend Jabez Branderham in the chapel of Gimmerdon Sow. And while I was half-consciously worrying my brain to guess what Jabez Branderham would make of his subject, I sank back in bed and fell asleep. Alas for the effects of bad tea and bad temper. What else could it be that made me pass such a terrible night? I don't remember another that I can at all compare with it since I was capable of suffering. I began to dream, almost before I ceased to be sensible of my locality. I thought it was morning, and I had set out on my way home with Joseph for a guide. The snow lay yards deep in our road, and as we floundered on, my companion wearied me with constant reproaches that I had not bought a pilgrim's staff, telling me that I could never get into the house without one, and boastfully flourishing a heavy-headed cudgel, which I understood to be so denominated. For a moment I considered it absurd that I should need such a weapon to gain admittance into my own residence. Then a new idea flashed across me. I was not going there. We were journeying to hear the famous Jabez Branderham preach from the text 70 times 7, and either Joseph the preacher or I had committed the first of the 71st, and were to be publicly exposed and excommunicated. We came to the chapel. I have passed it really in my walks twice or thrice. It lies in a hollow between two hills, an elevated hollow near a swamp, whose peaty moisture is said to answer all the purposes of embalming on the few corpses deposited there. The roof has been kept whole hitherto, but as the clergyman's stipend is only £20 per annum, and a house with two rooms threatening speedily to determine into one, no clergyman will undertake the duties of pastor, especially as it is currently reported that his flock would rather let him starve than increase the living by one penny from their own pockets. However, in my dream, Jabez had a full and attentive congregation, and he preached. Good God, what a sermon! Divided into 490 parts, each fully equal to an ordinary address from the pulpit, and each discussing a separate sin. Where he searched for them, I cannot tell. He had his private manner of interpreting the phrase, and it seemed necessary the brother should sin different sins on every occasion. They were of the most curious character, odd transgressions that I never imagined previously. Oh, how weary I grow! How I writhed and yawned and nodded and revived, how I pinched and pricked myself and rubbed my eyes, and stood up and sat down again, and nudged Joseph to inform me if he would ever have done. I was condemned to hear all out. Finally, he reached the first of the 71st. At that crisis, a sudden inspiration descended on me. I was moved to rise and denounce Jabez Branderham as the sinner of the sin that no Christian need pardon.
"Sir," I exclaimed, "sitting here within these four walls at one stretch, I have endured and forgiven the 490 heads of your discourse. 70 times 7 have I plucked up my hat and been about to depart. 70 times 7 have you preposterously forced me to resume my seat. The 491st is too much. Fellow martyrs have at him. Drag him down and crush him to atoms, that the place which knows him may know him no more." Thou art the man, cried Jabez after a solemn pause, leaning over his cushion. 70 times 7 times didst thou gapingly contort thy visage. 70 times 7 did I take counsel with my soul. Lo, this is human weakness. This also may be absolved. The 1st of 71st is come. Brethren, execute upon him the judgment written. Such honour have all his saints.
With that concluding word, the whole assembly, exalting their pilgrim staves, rushed round me in a body, and I, having no weapon to raise in self-defence, commenced grappling with Joseph, my nearest and most ferocious assailant for his. In the confluence of the multitude, several clubs crossed, blows aimed at me, fell on other sconces. Presently the whole chapel resounded with rappings and counter-rappings. Every man's hand was against his neighbour, and Branderham, unwilling to remain idle, poured forth his zeal in a shower of loud taps on the boards of the pulpit, which responded so smartly that at last, to my unspeakable relief, they woke me. And what was it that had suggested the tremendous tumult? What had played Jabez's part in the row? Merely the branch of a fir tree that touched my lattice as the blast wailed by and rattled its dry cones against the panes. I listened doubtingly an instant, detected the disturber, then turned and dozed and dreamt again, if possible, still more disagreeably than before. This time, I remembered I was lying in the oak closet, and I heard distinctly the gusty wind and the driving of the snow. I heird also the fir bough repeat its teasing sound, and ascribed it to the right cause, but it annoyed me so much that I resolved to silence it, if possible. And, I thought, I rose and endeavoured to unhasp the casement. The hook was soldered into the staple, a circumstance observed by me when awake but forgotten. I must stop it nevertheless, I muttered, knocking my knuckles through the glass and stretching an arm out to seize the importunate branch, instead of which my fingers closed on the fingers of a little ice-cold hand. The intense horror of nightmare came over me. I tried to draw back my arm, but the hand clung to it, and a most melancholy voice sobbed, "Let me in! Let me in!" "Who are you?" I asked, struggling meanwhile to disengage myself.
"Catherine Linton,"